Please join me in welcoming Julie L., our main speaker from Las Vegas.
Julie, alcoholic.
Julie.
The good news is I might be short, but I sound tall. So that's the good news. Thanks, Lee, for asking me to speak. And I think Lee asked me to speak maybe, I don't know, like 10 months ago. Like, he is honored. And since then, I was in Los Angeles, and then I moved to Vegas. And he was like, just remind you. And I was like, oh, damn, how am I going to get to wherever this is? So, you know, I kind of organized my schedule to come back to LA and spend the week there and then drive up today and go home tomorrow. So, you know, there's that part in the book, isn't it, about being inconvenienced, you know? And I, you know, and the longer, you know, I just think about, I never want to be too long sober that things become inconvenient for me. You know, my sobriety date is April 1993. And I never want to say, just leave it to the newcomer. I don't need to do that. I've done that already. Like, I want to stay spiritually fit. And the way I think about it is, like, in the morning I do prayer meditation and I hand my will and my life over to God and I say, your will, not mine, be done. And then Lee calls. Julie. Is this God's will? Or, you know, somebody asked me to sponsor them. And I say, yes, of course. Because I don't know half the time where I'm supposed to be or what I'm supposed to be doing, but if I turn my will and my life over, I just trust that I'm exactly where I'm meant to be. And the drive, like, I was dreading the drive. I was at a meeting on Wednesday and I was like, oh my God, I dread this drive. I hate driving. It's my work. I really hate it. And I was like, dreading it. And I get down to the place and it's so beautiful. And then I go for a walk and the sun is setting. I'm like so moved. And I'm like, how lucky am I? I didn't know that coming here was going to be a gift. Like, God was trying to give me a gift. And I didn't know that until I got here. But because I'd said yes, and because I made all those arrangements to get here, I got that gift. And I just feel like that's where I want to be. I always want to be in the middle of the bed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, so I'm feeling really grateful to be here. And glad I didn't kill myself driving up here. That's great. That's really good news. You know, so the accent is Irish. And yes, I've been there. Listen, I checked into the hotel today and the young one had an Irish name. And I said to her, oh, that's an Irish name. She says, that's why I am Irish. I'm chatting away to her. She goes, I said, oh, yeah, I'm Irish. She goes, oh, have you ever been? It's happened to me often. I was speaking one time in, be nameless, and I was a Saturday night speaker, and so somebody goes, oh, your accent's lovely. And I go, yeah, it's Irish. Like, have you ever been? Oh, my God. Like, so it's a regular thing, you know? It happens regularly. So, yes, I've been. I was born in Ireland. I don't know if people think I go home and listen to the BBC and try to... Like, I've got nothing else going on in my sad little life that I'm going to try and emulate an accent. I am not. So I'm like, oh, yeah. So, you know, the accent is Irish. I was born there. And you know, I was raised in this kind of wild, crazy house. And I always thought that was what made me alcoholic. And as I got sober, I realized that just gave me an inventory. You know, I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. That's what makes me alcoholic. I didn't know that. For many years, I thought it was because of the life I was living and the life I had and how I was treated so wrong. And, you know, but I was living this big, you know, my mom had 13 pregnancies and I'm the 10th child and 7 passed away, the 6 of us. And this is how warm and fuzzy my mother is. I was on an escalator with my mother one time. And there was a pregnant girl coming up the escalator. And my mother turns to me and goes, Jesus, someone had it in for her. And I said, be pregnant. She goes, Julie, no one wants to be pregnant. So that's how I was raised, very warm and fuzzy, with lots of siblings. And so, you know, my mom left my father. We went to England, and it sounds really glamorous, but we were living in a condemned building, with no electricity, no running water. We used the public toilet around the corner, and I mean, we were poor. I come from a very poor background, and my mother was alcoholic, and children were inconvenient, really. But you know, she started to get these cars, right? And she'd drive over to Ireland. It'd be like she'd pay £300 for these cars. And she'd drive over to Ireland, and we'd go over to Ireland, and she'd get poutine. Like, you know, you guys call it moonshine, but the Irish gave that to you all as a gift. It's actually called poutine. And I don't know about any of you guys, but, you know, when you drink that stuff, you can't actually breathe. And I've had some. So, you know, she used to smuggle it over from Ireland in statues of the Blessed Virgin Mary. You know the holy water bottles where you screw the head off Mary? And I know. Sorry. Screw the head off Mary and you'd put the poutine in there and you'd throw out the holy water. And she'd be coming back over the border, and she'd never had a license, my mother. She was involved in some criminal activity in the East End of London, some forgery and all that. And she'd have forged documents. She'd never had a driver's license in her whole life. It was always for, and she couldn't drive. Oh, mother of God, taking her life in her hands, getting in there. She was always drunk, you know. But she'd pop them all in the trunk, and we'd be all like, little steps, like all these kids in the car, and not a man to be seen. And the guys would pop open the trunk, and they'd be looking over, you know, and they'd be like looking at her, looking at the statues of Mary in the back of the car. They'd just flag her. Oh, thank you. I guess I did think it was holy. There was holy water in there, but we had this drinks cabinet. Right, this is my first experience. I was always raised in bars and all that. It's, you know, very cultural. And it is, and we had this bar in the house, of course, and it like made a click click noise. I had to reach up and open it, you know, and I started to learn to be able to open that without it making a click click noise. And I was thinking, Jesus wants me in here. and I'd find, my mother was always out drinking, and so I'd go over to the bar and I'd get that thing going, and I'd find Mary. She'd be sitting in there waiting for me, which could be the story of my life. And I'd take Mary out, I'd screw the head off Mary, I'd have a swig of the poutine. And like I said, you can't breathe. So you're like, you can feel everything popping, right? But you know, intuitively you know, it's gonna be worth it. Right? Intuitively I knew that at 10. I knew intuitively it was going to be worth it. And it was. And once I catch my breath, once I could breathe again, I'd put her head back on and I'd go back in. And I'd be grand for like 20 minutes. I'd be smoking cigarette butts and I'd be dancing around the kitchen. And then I'd be saying to myself, I wonder what Mary's doing. Back over. And that's how my drinking took off. And you know, I'm one of these people that, you know, before I started drinking, I was very, very intense, very, very concerned, right? And as soon as I had a drink, that left me. I didn't care about you and your sad little opinions and your sad little life, right? And that was like, wow, I love that freedom from bondage, right? And so I started to drink, and I started to cut myself with my drinking. Idea came into my mind, wouldn't that be a great idea? Oh yes, it would be, thank you for sharing. And I started to cut myself all the way through my drinking, and that was a big secret. And that's how I was at 10. And I'm in obsession immediately. It's like, when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking, and when I'm not thinking about drinking or drinking, I'm getting over drinking, planning my next drink. Now, there was always booze in my house because my mother was alcoholic, and always booze, and she was never paying attention. And I started to work in an Irish club then when I was like 13, and I had access to booze even more, right? And cutting myself and drinking, all that business. And that went on, and I started to drink at school. Like the obsession of the mind immediately. Like people talk about this invisible line. I never had an invisible line. Like once I started drinking, I was in. And, you know, I'd be working in this Irish club and I'd be stealing booze behind the counter and all that business. I was collecting glasses, you know. As soon as the shutters went down, I'm stealing booze from the optics, you know. Whatever it is, I'm drinking it, I don't care. I just need the effect. I don't care. I'm not fussy about what I drink. Even then, it was about the effect of alcohol, not about anything else. And so I was driven in that way, and I was starting to get into a lot of trouble. Started to drink at school. I'm Irish Catholic. Go to Catholic school. Got a school uniform on, and I'd go over to the corner shop at lunchtime, and I'd buy 4 cans of wine. And like, you know, they're in the like out of date section, like in one of those baskets in the front as you walk in. And I could get 4 cans of wine. And I don't think I'd ever even really seen a grape, that wine. But they'd give it to me. And I'd go over to the toilets at school in my lunch break, and I'd pound down those 4 cans because I'm not sharing and we're not having a laugh. And I'm not like, oh, let's be cool and drink together. I just want you to go away. I'm in the toilet pounding down 4 cans because now I've got 20 minutes left of my lunch break. I pound that down and I go back to class. Right? Now I'm cursed. I'm sure there's other Irish people in here tonight. I'm cursed, right? Because when I drink, I go like red, almost purple from the neck up. And my eyes are like piss holes in the snow. You know, whoop, 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 like backup lights. Like I look psychotic. Right? And I thought that's the only reason people knew I was drinking. So I was like, you know, like, Jesus. Like, I frighten people. Like, you know, you okay? And people would ask me that, you know, you are. I started to get into trouble. And I wasn't doing any school. My mother, it's an interesting thing. My father was illiterate, totally illiterate. And my mother was semi-illiterate. She was a very, very smart woman, but she was married and pregnant at 15. She could have done anything, but she was also alcoholic. So she worked in a laundromat and did some criminal enterprises in the East End of London for a long time. So we mixed a lot with a lot of the criminal, you know, whatever. And that was how I was raised. It's funny, my sister was just over visiting me in Vegas, my younger sister. Her and I, every day after school, we'd go up to the local pub where my mother'd drink, and we'd sit in the car that my mother didn't have a license for. We'd sit in the car, and we'd be sitting in there until closing time. And my mother brings out a bag of crisps and a bottle of Coke for dinner. And that's how it was. We were talking about that last week. And that's how I was raised, in that way. So when I started drinking, my drinking took off. People like me, that's what we do. And there was never any expectation of me. The expectation was, don't bring the cops to the door. That was it. That was it. And I lived up to all those expectations. So there was no like, I'm going to parents' evening. None of that going on, like nobody cared. And I just did my own thing, and so I was getting into more and more into my alcoholism. I was cutting myself, I was stealing booze, I was buying booze, I was working the club, doing all that stuff. And things were getting really out of hand, and I left school and went to hospice in the East End of London. And I left school without any education. I didn't know then, but I know now that I had a learning disability, and I was totally traumatised. I was getting beaten up regularly by my mother. And a very violent alcoholic, you know, and a lot of trauma. I'm not doing schoolwork. What? And so, you know, I ended up in the East End of London, and I was going to become a nun. Yes, that's right, people. And I was going to become a nun. I was going to enter the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary because Jesus wanted me as a sunbeam. I don't know. Jesus wanted me. And I felt called. I really felt seriously called to religious life. And really at that time, the church was like a saviour for me. Like it gave me a safe place to go. And I got to sing in the choir and it made me feel like I could do something. And it felt safe to me. I'd go to like prayer groups and all that stuff. And it was a safe refuge for me, the church. So I wanted to enter religious life, but I started to get into a lot of trouble. My problem was alcoholic, but I asked one of the people if they would put me on the floor in the hospice, stay living there with the other nuns. Yeah. And their problem was they said yes. And so they put me on the floor with the other nuns. Now I'm on the floor with all the sisters, the real sisters. And I'm listening to Guns N' Roses. Full blast, drinking a bottle of whiskey. Turn around, bitch, I got use for you. Besides, you ain't got nothing better. Do not bored. Yeah! Right? I'm all that. Or I'm singing, you remember that song? Like, white lines going through my mind. And all the while I think of you. Boom, boom, boom. Oh my God. That bottle of whiskey, a pack of razor blades, I'm rolling, mate. So I was like, it's like, and then you have a sister Anne tapping on the door. Julie, love, are you okay in there? So, you know, I used to put my empties in Sister Anne's bin at night, because you'd put the bins outside the door, you know. And I'd put all my empties, my bin, you could eat out of it, but I'd put all the empties in her bin. And I'd hear the Irish girls, a lot of Cork girls, my accent is from the Midlands, but the Cork girls have a different accent. And I'd hear all the domestic girls going, Jesus, girl, did you see Sister Anne's bin? I think she's a bit of an alky. And I thought it was hilarious. You know, I bought myself a cherry glow-in-the-dark job tracksuit. I don't know how. I woke up out of blackout and it was there. I assumed it was mine. I'm 4'11", so it's children's size, apart from the knockers, you know. And I'm like, oh. So anyway, I wear this, and I've got my hair shaved now in a one. This is very long tonight. I got my hair shaved and I've got this cherry tracksuit. I'd have a few drinks and I'd go over for evening vespers, evening prayer, because I'm still going to be coming on. And I'm walking in, I'm lit up like a Christmas tree. And I'm there, you know, and they're singing and I'm thinking, I'm in the back glowing. I swear if you could turn off the lights between my face and the tracksuit, I was glowing in the dark, mate. But it's like, I'd be there and they'd be singing. I'd say, oh, they need a hand, you know. So I'd be like, Salve Regina, Mater Misericordiae, Vitae Dulcedo, Espes Nostra Salve. Right? And they'd be like, and I'd be like lit up singing, going, that's right, don't worry, sisters, I got you. Now I know they're looking back going, what in God's name is that in the back of the room? But, you know, it was so crazy. And so I want to say this around obsession. You know, I saw an advert for Castlemaine 4X, Australian, and I thought, oh, I'll go to Australia. And so I did. I took a leave of absence for a month and I went to Australia and stayed in all these different convents, and I got into a bit of trouble because I got a couple of the nuns drunk and got into a bit of trouble and travelled around. And I always share this. I just found these pictures recently again. I was on a glass bottom boat in one of the seven wonders of the world, which was the Barrier Reef. I'm on a glass bottom boat. I'm 20 years of age. I've got long sleeves on me because I've been cutting myself, right? And I've got a can of Foster's in my hand. And there's girls my age, and they're in bikinis, and they're like, oh, hey, let's go snorkeling. Right? And I'm like, oh my God, they're so pathetic, right? Like, we like that, aren't we? We like to look down our nose on people when we're really in the gutter ourselves, and you know. And I, at that time, I start taking pictures of the can of Foster's, because after all, it's a beautiful can. And when the sun hits it, it's even nicer. And I'm taking pictures of this can of Foster's. And I haven't got one picture of the Great Barrier Reef. And I was on a glass-bottom boat. Now, if that's not obsession of the mind, all it would have taken me is to go like this, excuse me, Ken. I'm back. Didn't happen. And so I come back from there, you know, and I get really sick. I drank a full bottle of brandy one night and my heart was coming out of my chest and it was having a horrible time. And then somebody pissed me off, and frankly, it's not difficult. Like, I have a very sharp hair trigger. Like, I'm like, I've worked so hard in my sobriety and not losing my, I'm like, I'm just gonna punch you in the neck and then drag you across the desk. How about that? Like, that's just how I feel. Like, I've always been driven with that kind of intensity, right? So I go home, somebody pissed me off. I'm in my nurse's uniform, and I go into my room, into my little room with the green carpet and the blue bin, tiny little place, right? And I'm drinking a bottle of whiskey. And I'm listening to Patsy Cline. I'm looking out the window, you know. I always like songs that match what I'm doing, you know. I know there's some of you out there. And so I'm like, you know, I'm looking out the window and I'm singing away. And, you know, I don't want to play house. No, I don't want to play house. Again, Sister Anne, no. Anyway, I'm coming back in, go into the sink, and I put down my bottle of whiskey, and I cut myself really badly. And I'm suddenly struck sober. I'm 21 at the time. And I catch eyes with myself, and the book talks about this jumping off place. I catch eyes with myself and I think, well, what am I going to do? I can't live with alcohol and I can't live without it. At 21. And I picked up the whiskey and I drank for another three and a half years. And that's how it was for me. I tried many things. I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. I'm a huge swimmer. I've always swam. I like to quieten my head. My head is very noisy. And so I like to swim. I swim miles, right? I didn't know I had a propensity to swim until I started swimming. And so it was the one where I was trying to control and enjoy my drinking. I'd do a split shift at work, so I'd be off in the middle of the day and I'd go to the swimming pool and I'd swim 100 laps in 80 minutes. And then I'd go double whiskey, double whiskey, double whiskey back to work. And that was a way I was like, somebody would say to me, have you been drinking? Because, you know, I'm lit up. And I'd be like, can you swim 100 laps in 80 minutes? And they're like, what? And I was going, exactly. When you can, get back to me. And what? Like, that's my defense. I know, it's crazy. And so I was in a lot of trouble. But the truth is, I just didn't care. I'm in that place now where I can drink a few bottles of booze and be drunk. Or I can drink a whole bottle of whiskey and my head is wide awake and my body is drunk. And that's a horrible place to be, isn't it? Because you're like, oh my God, who is this guy? Oh my God, where am I? And I can't speak, I can't move, but I'm wide awake. And drinking was becoming very unpredictable like that. I didn't know if I was going to black out with a couple of drinks. So in that way, you know, in that way, it stopped working for me. It was becoming scary. I came out of a blackout one night in the East End of London, very rough neighbourhood, very, very rough neighbourhood. And I come out of blackout and I'm apparently, I come out of blackout and I've got a drinking hand. And last time I remember I was in the bar. And now I'm somewhere in someone's garden somewhere. And I look over and my friend who came with me is having sex right next to me with this guy who has a leather jacket on and something going on, right? So I'm like, oh my God, yeah, I'm Catherine. Oh my Lord. And I try and stumble my way back into the house and I realise, been in those places where there's like one light and no lampshade and it's just like seems to be swinging. Everyone's on the floor getting lauded and apparently I'd ended up in a biker's den in East End of London. And there was no, I want to go to the loo, but there was no door on the toilet. I remember that. And I'm like, oh no. And then I come out, there's all these bikes. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. I come out, there's no pathway. It's like boards to this house. And I come out of there I don't even know how. Next thing I remember, I'm at home in my bed. Don't know what happened. So, you know, I have no idea what went on. I say thank God for blackouts is what I say. So, you know, my last drink, I went to a retreat centre in the East End of London. And I was going to get sober, and I wasn't going to hurt myself anymore, and I was good. It was good. And I was going to enter religious life, and it was in a convent, and I was living in the convent, and I was living in the basement. Church was above me, and I wasn't going to do anything. And 2 days later, I am so drunk they had to call an ambulance for me, and they're walking me up and down. The nuns are walking me up and down the pathway when the ambulance got there. I'd cut myself really badly, and I'd smashed up my room. Like, it was a lovely room, and I'd never had anything that nice before. Everything I've ever had was all secondhand. You know, we were really poor, so they gave me a lovely room, and I smashed it all up. I love inanimate objects when I'm drinking. I love to put my fists through them, and anything that was worth anything to me was gone. Just in rage, and doors, wardrobes happened to be a favourite of mine. You know, and I smashed up this place, and that was, and I drank for 9 months there like that. And my last drink, I ended up going, I was drinking all day long, and I should have been working, and so people weren't very happy. I showed up at like midnight or something, drunk off my ass. I'd been to cut myself and all that carry on. And I got into the chapel where Sister Anne was, with like 60 young people having a reconciliation service. And apparently I bled all over the carpet and told Sister Anne where to go. So I wake up that morning, I'm 24 and a half years of age, right? I wake up, I do inventory, I'm all cut up, my room's all smashed up, which is normal. I can't remember anything that happened. I'm crawling on my hands and knees because now I'm throwing up and I'm bringing up blood. I'm at another jumping off place. I'm on my knees throwing up, and I just think, you should just kill yourself. Booze has stopped working. And isn't it like, you know that phrase we have in AA, you know, life on life's terms. We have to live life on life's terms. I didn't know it then, but I know it now. That's what I was afraid of. What do I do if I'm not drinking? What am I going to do? I mean, I was raised in bars. I drink in bars. I'm a bar. Like, what do you do if you're not drinking? And I didn't want to face the idea. And I hated me and I hated you. And I didn't want to face the idea of being sober. And I ended up going upstairs. Nobody was speaking to me because apparently I made a tit of myself at Sister Anne. And this Irish guy was there. And he basically 12-stepped me. And the only reason I listened to him was because he was Irish. Because I'd work with all these British people. And they just don't get, they're a bit anal, the British, in case you don't know. The Irish, we like a bit of fun, you know. And so they didn't get it, you know, they don't get it. And he was Irish, and I listened to him, and he basically 12-stepped me. And I was ready. I was in enough pain, I was about to kill myself. I'd made the decision downstairs as I was throwing up that I'm going to kill myself. And he 12-stepped me that morning. So funny, I met him on a Zoom meeting a couple of months ago, and I was like, oh my Lord, he's still sober, so am I. And he was 9 months sober, and he was on fire at Alcoholics Anonymous. He was on fire at Alcoholics Anonymous. And he brought me to my first meeting. I haven't drank since my first meeting. And like I said, that was over 32 years ago. And I guess I was ready, you know. And I didn't come in and go, oh, look at all the differences, and oh, I'm too young. Look, I just didn't care. I was so beaten. I was so beaten down. And I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I knew there was something seriously wrong with me. So there was a woman there who started to bring me to meetings. And I started to walk everywhere, you know. I realized, you know, that intensity that I had before I started drinking came back like tenfold. I was intense. Somebody said to me, morning, Julie. They're just being polite. How are you? Oh my God, I tell you, I was abused when I was 5. Damn! You know, like, I was like intense, you know? And I'd start going to these meetings. I'd walk everywhere, you know? Like, I'd walk to meetings. I had no money at all. And they'd let me stay there for free, right? So I'd walk to these meetings, and they're like two-hour walks. I have sponsees now, won't walk around the corner, living in California. I'm like, where were you? Oh my God, my mind didn't come. What? Yeah, why don't you walk? It's like a 30-minute walk. You know, they're like, I'm really tired. Why? You're not doing anything. You're thinking about yourself all day long, for Christ's sake. Like, get your ass there, right? What? Like, but I used to walk to this meeting. It was a 2.5-hour walk to Epping Forest, this meeting I'd go to on a Wednesday night, right? I'd walk there. And this is my first spiritual experience. I was about 3 months sober, and I'd be walking. I'm angry. I'm so angry for the first 2 years of my sobriety. I'm like pounding. I'm walking. And people would toot the horn, and I'd be like... And I'd get to the meeting, and these Irish guys would go, Jesus, Julie, I saw you. I was going to pull over and give you a lift. And he gave me the bird, and I don't feck her, never walk it. I said, oh, no! So it was like my first spiritual experience where I was willing to do something different. So I'd walk there every Wednesday, and it's raining, and it's cold, and it's through the forest, and I'm like, and somebody took the horn, I'm like, oh, that was a spiritual awakening. Carl Jung talks about that in The Psychic Rearrangement, a shift in ideas, attitudes, and emotions. And I was like, oh, Lord, I don't want these guys to abuse me. And then I started to get lifts to meetings that way. It's amazing. And, you know, for a long time I did that. I walked a lot, and I wanted to drink for about 17 months. And if you knew, I'm sorry, but that's how it was for me. I used to walk everywhere. I'd walk to this meeting that was a five-hour walk on a Saturday morning. The meeting started at 12. Not 4 hours, because I'd leave my house at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'd just walk to this meeting. I'd get there at 12. I didn't want you to speak to me. I'm not interested in you touching me. None of that business. Oh, hi. No. Right? And I was, you know, but what I did do is, like, I started to go to meetings, and I started to feel like, and I'd walk to these meetings, and it unwound my head. I still walk a lot, and I swim a lot because of that. It unwinds my mind, and I'm able to think about things, get some clarity. And no matter how long so we are, it's great. Just, you know, I did that just today when I just went walking. And, you know, I started to learn how to read and write when I got sober. I had a hard time reading and writing. I told you my parents were not interested in education. And a friend of mine who was a nun helped me learn how to use a dictionary and how to read and write again properly and all that stuff. And so I started to be able to read at meetings. And I knew that I just felt better in meetings. Like, the meetings in Britain were an hour and a half long. No break. And I wish we didn't have breaks here in the United States, because my head's really busy and I get settled, and then you want to chat to me again. And then I get settled again, and then the meeting's over. I'm like, oh, like, it's good for me to get quiet, you know? Like, I like the hour and a half where I'm just quiet. And I start to go to meetings regularly, and there was a woman who was really kind to me, and I'm suspicious immediately. Oh, what's her deal? And basically she was very sweet, and I got sober in the April, and in September I turned 25 and thought my life was over. And she bought me a gift. I still feel really moved by it. She bought me a gift. It was a bit of kindness. And I don't know kindness. I know rough and ready. You come at me, I've got this. Not a problem. Right? Not a problem. I told you how, you know, my family were very rough. But she was kind to me. She bought me a gift, and I was embarrassed to open it in front of her. I was embarrassed because I'm awkward and I'm uncomfortable. I don't know how to manage kindness. I'm overwhelmed by it. And I get out of the car, and I quickly run in to see what it is. And it was a bottle of perfume. Perfume. Like, I looked, like, at that time my hair was really shaved, and I was like, extra. I've become very feminine, apparently. If you get sober, you too can have what I've got. And, you know, but she bought me this perfume, and I ran down to the shop to see how much it was. Like, how much was I worth to her? I just... so moved. And you know what they say, don't you? Be careful how you treat the newcomer, because one day they could be your sponsor. That's how it is here. And when I was 5 years sober, she relapsed and asked me to sponsor her. And I wouldn't have stayed sober if it wasn't for her. She'd bring me to Stansted for coffee after meetings on a Friday night. And she'd let me talk. I had no money, so she'd buy the coffee. And she was just kind to me. She said, I'm never going to be your sponsor, Julie. It's not something I do. But I'm happy to be friends and take it. And she was great. And I wouldn't, and that's all I needed at the time. About 3 years sober. My grace period was over. I'm in a relationship that I'm still in. Actually, we'll be together 31 years this month. I was like 22 months sober. She was 18 months sober, and amazing, kind woman. I'd lost my whole concept of God, because then I discovered that I liked women, and that was like, I'm hardcore Catholic. And that was really torturous for me. I lost my whole concept. It's where it says in the book, I believed in God, but felt like God didn't believe in me anymore. It was heartbreaking. I was very involved in the church. And you know, I got in this relationship, and still in. And she said something to me that I didn't like. And I kicked the door in her face, 3 years sober. Now, she'd kill me. She's a black belt in judo. But thank God she's passive. But she jumped back, thank God she's nimble, and the door missed her. And I couldn't believe, 3 years sober, that I kicked the door in her face. The rage in me. And I got a sponsor. I started to cry, and I got a sponsor, and I started to do the work. And I got a sponsor who was kind, because I don't do kind. I'm like, yeah, what? Yeah, like, you know. And I don't do kind at that time, and I got the sponsor who was an older woman. She was so kind to me that she frightened me. She'd hug me. She'd go, hello, Julie, love Harry. I'm like, oh my God, she's touching me. I couldn't do it. I was so awkward around physical contact. And she was very sweet. She gave me my first experience of going through the steps. And it was so hard for me because, listen, step four, right? The first three columns are like, oh, you've hurt my feelings. This is what you did. You're so mean to me. Right? Fourth column, putting out of the minds the wrongs others have done. Where are we to blame? What? I'm only reacting. Like, if you'd had my upbringing, you'd be the same too. I mean, hey, this is all. And I started to realize that I actually wasn't a very good daughter. I wasn't a very good partner. I wasn't a very good friend. Like, you'd say to me, Jesus, Julie, I'd love to go for coffee. You give me your number, and as soon as you'd leave, I'd drop the number in the bin. Like, I wasn't close to people. And I kept people at arm's length, and I wasn't kind. I wasn't kind to me, and I wasn't kind to you. And I started to learn that I had a lot of growing up to do. I had a lot of, I didn't want to be vulnerable, really. It was like my dukes were up, sober for a long time. Like, oh yeah, like, all the bravado, I'm going to slap you down before you get a chance to slap me down, all that business. And I'm good at it. And like I said, I started to go through the steps because I'd learned to read and write again properly and do all that stuff. And I started to realize, you know, I need to change. Like, I got a horrible experience of depression and then rage. Like, that was where I was, trapped between those two things. And I needed to learn a different way of connecting to a power greater than myself. I love Catholicism, love Catholicism. I still do. For my 50th, we went to, little sidetrack, I guess, but for my 50th, we ended up going to Rome. My mother just died, and I was devastated. And my wife said to me, what do you want to do for your 50th? I was so lost when my mum died. I was so, caught me so off guard. Oh, I still feel it. And I listened to these monks of Norcia, right? Every morning, this Gregorian chant, I listened to that. And in meditation, I said to her, I wanna be here for my 50th. Now, I'm not apologizing for that, because I work for a living and I can afford to do that. So I was like, you too can work for a living and save up and do that too, right? So I was like, we saved up, and she got me some tickets, and we went to Rome, and then we drove up to Norcia. And on my 50th birthday, I was with those monks that I listened to every morning. sitting in their monastery, listening. And it was so beautiful for me. It was a lovely experience for me. And that night, my mum, they brought a cake to the table. I didn't think anybody knew it was my birthday. And me and my wife had a little piece of the cake, and it was coffee cake, which is the only dessert my mother ever used to eat. It was just like a God shot, you know, just like a God shot. And so I'd lost all that, and I really tried. So I started with Native American stuff first. My wife's sponsor was Native American, and in Holland, actually. We went to Holland, and she helped with some like Native American stuff. So I did like some smudging, which I still do. Like the action, right? And I was just saying earlier, action doesn't care how contentious you are of it. So I'd start to burn this one, and I'd be like, okay, I'm going to please clear my mind, help me to think more peacefully. And I'd put it around my body, help me be surrounded by love. Because I was just like, oh, and then it helped me walk more softly. So I started again like that. And I've built up a very, you know, I hear people who are as long sober as I am, and they don't, I mean, I have I always set time aside in the morning for prayer meditation. Now, I'll change it up because my sponsor tells me that every spiritual tool needs to be picked up and re-examined, right? And I was doing the same thing for a while, and I started to learn the barrel, the Irish drum, and it's joyful. It's so joyful in the morning. And then I started to learn the Native American flute. I was playing that in the morning, just enjoying these things, putting these into my morning meditations. I always try to make time for that. And you know, listening to people who educate myself around different concepts of a power greater than ourselves. And I'm really, I do that regularly. And I've learned that over the years, you know, and I've learned that I like the quietness. Like I'm still wired for sound. Right, like I roar a lot. When COVID happened, I couldn't swim, and my wife's like, "Oh hell no!" She bought me a rowing machine, plumped it right in the middle of the living room. Off you go, baby. So I was rowing. I was rowing for an hour in the mornings, you know. And it was like she got me one with water in it, so it sounds like when I'm swimming. Shh, shh, shh. It like quietens me, and I do that in the morning before I go to work. Before I take the edge off in the mornings, when I work out, I do prayer meditation. And I've found like, I want to try and lighten my little corner of the world, right? And I remember doing a workshop one time on step 11, right? Prayer meditation, and this guy stands up and he goes, "That's all great. My girlfriend was gonna come tonight, but she did her meditation for 6 hours today. She was exhausted." I'm like, bloody hell, it's like, you know, self-obsession is one thing, you know, but it's like, settle down. Like, in my prayer meditation, it has to be practical. It has to be practical. You know, in the book it says, you know, we've come to believe, God, we'd like to keep our head in the clouds with him, but our feet ought to be firmly planted on earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work has to be done. That's really bad news. I'd like to just levitate all day and not speak to anybody. And I think, oh my God, I'm outlined to Jesus, you know. But then you come in and I'm like, oh, I get a bit interrupted. You know, so I've worked really hard I still work really hard trying to be kind, trying to be loving, trying not to get my dukes up. I know when I'm off because I can get a little aggressive, a little sharp. I know I'm off. And so I have to regroup, get deeper into meditation, really do some work and thinking, what's going on here? What's happening here with me? And, you know, this disciplined life, there's a discipline in our life, right? And I just can't rest on my laurels at 32 years sober. I don't want to. I know what happens. I see it. And, you know, I love like my work. You know, when I got sober and I told you I had no education, I went back to school. And I thought, they let me in. It's a different system than it is here. They let me in because, the work I was doing in the convent. And I started to go back to school. I'm like, oh my God, I'm the first person in my family ever to get any education. And I'm like, wow, this is cool. And I was sitting there for months, God, this is great. And then they gave us an assignment, and I had very little formal education. And they gave us an assignment, and the pass mark was 37. So the assignments came back. And I'm like, I can do anything I want in AA. This is really great. And the assignments come back, and I'm frightened to open it. Everybody else was getting 98 and 99, 97. And I couldn't look at mine because I knew I failed. And I knew that the jig was up. I wasn't going to school. People like me don't go to school. I go to school. So I couldn't look at it for like 3 days. I was living at the YMCA. £10 a week for food. Yeah, blimey, good times. And I was frightened to look at it. And so, you know, we get like that, and then we get sick of ourselves. We just get on with it, don't we? And so I opened the drawer and I looked at it. And I didn't get no 97, I didn't get no 98, but I got 37, the pass mark. And I was like, I can do something with this. I can do something with this. And I did. I got my bachelor's, I got a master's, got another master's, I got a doctorate about 10 years ago. And it's like I have a life, I have a profession, I have a license, all this business, right? And I work a lot in oncology, which makes me have to be soft. Because people are really vulnerable. And I can't go, oh yeah, how's it going? I did make a mistake in a... I'm not going to say this. But I made a mistake in... I was running a bereavement group, you know. I like the study of thanatology, study of death and dying, right? And I was doing a bereavement group, and I walk in, and somebody said, I say, hey, how are you doing? Oh, well, okay. How are you doing? My very first night running this group. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm alive and kicking. Oh. Okay. So, you know. So I've worked very hard on building a life for myself, you know. And I've always kept... I know, somewhat fine. I had to work in that group for 2 hours after that. Jesus, you idiot. You know, but I've learned, you know, that I'm perfectly imperfect. I've learned that love is always offered, it's never forced. And I like this saying, you know, like, you know, the more noble the desire, the more fragile the container. Like, the more noble the desire, the more fragile the container. Because sometimes I can be, like, rigid, and it needs to be perfect, and it needs to be, and I, you know. And I've learned that makes me fragile. Like, I need to wear things like a bit of a loose garment. I need not to take things so seriously. Like, the sun is going to rise and set again tomorrow. And I'm like, oh yeah. Like, I've learned all that in my sobriety. I've worked really hard on my anger. I rarely lose my temper anymore. I still lose it, I rarely lose it. And when I do, I get exhausted. And I don't do any damage anymore. I know what to do when I'm angry. It's what I do when in that. My sponsor one time, I was really disappointed, and I said to my sponsor, is it not okay for me to be disappointed? Like, this person's an idiot, is it not okay for me to be? And she says, Julie, it's okay for you to be disappointed, but it's what you do with the disappointment's the problem. Because in the disappointment, I separate myself from you, right? And keeps me isolated. And I've worked really hard on all this stuff, and I continue to work really hard on all this stuff. And like I said, coming here today, it's like, it was a gift for me. And I didn't know that. I was like mourning about, oh God, I've got to drive on my own. Because, you know, the truth is, I don't want to, like, my wife's like, why don't you bring in a sponsor? What, so I could be held hostage for 3 hours? Speak and then be held hostage again on the way home. It's like I just want to be quiet. I want to be quiet. And so that's how I am. I can be a little spiky still, and that's all right. I get to be perfectly imperfect here, and I get to show up, and I get to just do the best I can. And I figure that if I say yes, then God's in charge of that. I don't know who's meant to hear me tonight, but if one person's meant to hear me, I was meant to be here. And I get, it's none of my business who that was. And I love being sober. I love having some integrity. I love showing up and being where I say I'm going to be. And thanks to you for letting me speak.
Can we give her another round of applause?